Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamal Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamal Murray, and we have a very special guest. We are celebrating Women's History Month this month, and we are here with one of the greatest players of all time, somebody that has had a tremendous impact on tennis and is one of the nine people who are the reason that women on this tour now make what they make and have the opportunities that they have. We are here with Rosie Casale. Rosie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. It's nice to be here. And in my own house.
I know that's right. You're in the place to be right now because the world is headed to Palm Springs right now to compete. Yeah.
Indian Wells Tennis Gardens for the BNP. Yeah, absolutely. Funny, I walk my dog over there, so everything's gotten very crowded with all the cars coming in and stuff, so it makes it not so much fun.
we take away your peace, right? Because the desert is like peaceful and the grass is always green despite, you know, I've never seen so much underground irrigation anywhere in the world.
Yeah, well, we had some ceiling irrigation. We had a little bit of rain last night, which doesn't happen very often, but the sun is shining and it's dried everything up. So we do need some rain in the desert.
So you and your crew, the original nine, you, BJK, you all, I mean, took an incredible stance back in the day for these girls to have the opportunities they have now. I remember when I was first introduced to you, I was talking to Billy and she said, oh, Rosie, come out. Do you know Rosie? I said, of course I know of Rosie, but I never met her. And I was so shocked at your height because when I hear about Rosie, I think of, and I hear you speak and all the things you used to stand up and say, and, you know, just sort of like your fearlessness, I thought you'd be at least 6'2", but you're 5'2".
I certainly wish I was 6'2". Oh my gosh, that would have been so much fun. 5'2¼", add that, but perhaps because of my age, I probably shrunk a little bit. Great moments to think about it. And last year we were very fortunate to enjoy a wonderful tribute at the International Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport. To be inducted as a group, that was quite an honor. You know, we fought for that opportunity, and you know, I'm so happy that the Hall of Fame Board of Directors and committee decided that they may be able to change some of their bylaws to include groups, because certainly the original nine were a very special group of women who really, when I keep thinking about it and I say, God, generally you have nine individual women, but for a change, they all agreed on the same thing, that we needed to fight, that we needed to, you know, stick together. And no matter what happened, whether we got suspended by the USLTA at the time, the governing body, we needed to stick together for this purpose of getting women's tennis on the map with equal pay. And, you know, we were very fortunate that things went our way.
So, you know, one of the things that sticks out to me is when you won your first Family Circle Cup in 1973 and you won $30,000, which at the time was the biggest purse in women's tennis.
I think in men's tennis as well. I think at the time in 1973, that was the biggest purse either for men or women. And so, you know, it was an exciting time because that was the first time that we were nationally televised on NBC. And it's always nice to be the first. I was the first one to win the Virginia Slims of Houston in 1970 when we broke away from, you know, the Pacific Southwest and Jack Kramer and Gladys Helbin's dollar bill that we contracted. So Family Circle Cup, now the Credit One Charleston Open. That was a great moment to, especially to beat Nancy on clay. I mean, I remember that I was down 5-2 and getting killed, and I decided, well, we're playing on clay and she's great on clay, and I drop shot it, and you know, 5-2, 5-3, 5-4, I ended up winning, and it was kind of a wonderful moment to be able to say that I won that first Family Circle Cup and the great prize of $30,000. So you know what, you could buy a 450 SL Mercedes convertible for $20,000. So $20,000 went to my convertible.
So that was gonna be my next question, is because, you know, nowadays the kids get their big payday and they gotta like splurge on something. So I was gonna ask you at that time, what was your splurge? What was your reward to yourself?
So that was my reward. I went to Mercedes-Benz on Beverly Wilshire. I remember looking at this red car, beautiful, 450 SL, 1973. Walked right in there and walked right out driving it. So that was the exciting moment that I could certainly enjoy my $30,000. And, you know, it was really a monumental moment to have said that we had the biggest prize money ever awarded to a woman or a man. And, you know, from there, obviously, things have gotten a lot better for women, a lot better for tennis. Lots of money out there.
A lot of money. I mean, lose first round of a slam now is $100,000.
I know it's unbelievable, you know, what even the qualifiers make more than what we made in 1970, 71, 72, 73. Amazing. Billie Jean made $100,000 in the first year of the Virginia Slim. She had to play just about everything. We played singles, doubles, whatever we could play. And, you know, she was the first one to make $100,000. And that was a real incredible journey that she had in doing so. And being the first. So it's always nice, isn't it, to be the person to go down in the record books.
So take me back, because, you know, you and I always talk about the limitations of the sport. You know, you deal with a lot of kids. You're born in San Fran, or from San Fran.
Yeah, I was born and raised in San Francisco. Yeah.
And how did you get into it? Because most of the time, you know, like I'm probably one of the few people, no matter who the player is and where they're from, I always am just curious, right? Even if we're competing against them, I said, now, how did you start playing tennis?
Yeah.
And most of the people say, I grew up across the street from a tennis club, or my mom or dad played tennis.
Yeah.
Was that your story?
So my story was that my dad was a soccer player, but when he had injuries and broken ankle and what have you, he needed to do something. And he's from San Salvador, Central America. And they migrated to the States sometime in late 30s. And so when he started to play recreational tennis out at Gonge Park, I would see him, you know, gear up every weekend, put on his whites, you know, take the racket out of that wooden press. And I would, you know, bug him and say, please take me. I want to go to Gonge. And finally he did and started taking me, and I would hit against the wall. And then when they were done, I would come and hit with him and all the other, you know, people that would hit with kids, because you know how things are. They don't ever want to hit with kids, but that's how I got started. I must have been about eight and a half years old. And I just couldn't remember not being able to hit the ball. I mean, it was like, you know, this was me. This was natural. This is what I wanted to do. And that's, you know, I was fortunate that I found it at, when I was eight and a half years old.
And then did your dad teach you, and for how long?
Well, of course, you know, he taught me throughout my, you know, junior years till I was 13, 14, 15. And of course, we would have our arguments. No, I think I need to do this. I need to do that. And finally, as you get older, you know, you decide to say that, you know, everything, right? You know best. But I think once I started traveling and, you know, when I was 16, 17, and of course, you know, the game grew, I grew. Well, not necessarily in size, but certainly in, yeah, I grew in knowing a lot more. but he gave me basically my strokes and you know, all the things that, you know, the time that parents give kids. I mean, you know, there's so much schlepping them all over to the tournaments. I work with some kids, a couple of kids now, and, you know, I know how it feels when you're getting up early and taking them to the tournament and God knows what, you have to hang out all day long. It's tough. So, you know, you got to have a parent like that who's willing to put in the time. So, you know, later on, we do thank them, you know, in ways of wanting to be the best. And of course, when I started to play, I you know, I really felt I could be.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, you know, it's funny. So you talk about the time that your dad invested schlepping you around. When I sort of have people come into my program, especially dads, and they have daughters, and I'm going to say, hey, this game will give you two things. Number one, it should give your kid a college scholarship if you commit. But number two, it's going to give you so much time in the car with your kid that your relationship with your kid is going to be so deep. Right. And it can be good or bad. When it gets like 13 or 14, if you become a crazy tennis dad, it can go bad. But when you look at the relationship between junior tennis players and their parents, they are so deep compared to team sports where the coach puts 15 boys on the bus, takes them, right? Boys or girls.
Yeah.
And so correct. I think that that is one of the greatest gifts that this sport gives to kids and their parents.
Certainly in the former years, when I look at some of the things, though, I think sometimes that the parents cannot let go. And so that presents a unique problem. You know, I feel that when I look at some parents and they're so invested, and I can understand, I mean, you know, they paid for everything, their time, you know, they care, they, like I said, slap you all over the place. So it's understandable that sometimes the kids feel like they owe something to the parent. And, you know, unfortunately, it manifests itself. I see that in some of the situations in professional tennis with the players, either the men or the women, basically the same. You got fathers as coaches. You got sometimes mothers as coaches, but they know when to stop and ask for better coaching. But I don't know that the male daddies know that. I think you know who I'm talking about, but you know,
we always think we're gonna forever be the coach. The dads are hard in a step away.
Well, I think it's good in the beginning, and I think it's good even if you bring in somebody, you know, that could help, because it's always better with a different outside look at things. And sometimes you get so involved and you think, you know, and I got to say that unless you've been at a certain level of playing and coaching, you're not going to know the ins and outs. You just will not. I don't care.
Do you remember 2017, the night before the US Open, you were actually at Billy's house when I came to watch
Absolutely.
My
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And one of the biggest gifts that I would say that I received was early when I started traveling on tour, just sitting and listening, asking a question. And when you and Billy get to talking, I mean, I ain't got to say a word for 30 minutes because y'all just not going to stop. But asking a question. So what do you think she's going to feel tomorrow? I have no idea because I never played a Grand Slam final. So what do you think? And that turned into like 2 hours. And like between you and Billy fighting for the floor. I mean, that was one of the greatest gifts. So you talk about being willing to listen and enlist help. And for me, I'm like, I got no ego. If you're going to give me one thing that I can leave here and give to her, that's going to help her win and help me win, right? Because when she wins, I win, then I'm going to take it. So that was one of the biggest gifts that I've ever received.
Well, you know, that's good that you think that way and feel that way, because often, you know, there are a lot of coaches that may not feel that way, that feel they may know everything and they don't want any intrusions. And of course, our generation always talked about tennis. I mean, we played it and we played against one another. We practiced against one another. We did everything with one another, and we would talk about our matches, you know, really analyze them and talk. And we enjoyed it. Nowadays, these kids don't talk about tennis. They really don't talk about the match, or, you know, it's just the coach. The coach, you know, may want to say something. Well, we're not going to discuss it. I don't want to talk about it right now. So it's a little bit different. I mean, we always want to talk tennis, talk shop, you know, and I think that's why we are better students of the game, because we really learn the ins and outs, and we learn other perspective, you know. Okay, and Jones, you know, had a great slice, great touch and forehand. And if she could kill you six love, it didn't matter how long it would take, but she'd kill you six love, you know. And why she felt the way she felt, why she played the way she, I mean, we all shared things and we were all helpful to one another. But because you have a different, obviously, perspective, and you have different dynamics here with players really having their own team, you know, they don't share at all. And I'm not saying all of them, there may be some that do, but we're not that privy to it because we're not really that close to the players, you know. That I kind of always complain about this to the WTA, that as the original nine, as the founders of the tour, we should be able to go everywhere and anywhere, just like the NFL players can step foot in the locker room or on the field and feel that they're a part of it. They've been a part of it. We don't feel that way. Certainly, let me speak for myself. I do not. And we know that, hey, locker room's sacred. Would I go in there if somebody of today's player are in there? No. Would I go in there later on when everybody's gone? Yes. You know, Because we felt the same way. We've been there. So these kind of restrictions, I hate. You can only do this. We should be able to go anywhere, everywhere, anytime, anywhere, period.
Well, let me ask you this, because you see a lot of girls on tour now struggling, whether it be emotionally, struggling with the balance on, you know, maybe they got married, had a baby, whatever, having to come back. You know, do you feel like there is this sort of gap, right? So we've got the original nine and all that you all did for the game, right? But if you think about now, somebody that's 18 years old on tour, who was born in 2004, may not be as connected to what you all did in 1970, 71. Yeah. Right, yeah. Because it's been 30 years, born 30 years later, 50, but they probably need 50, to be. 50. Because some of the same struggles with the player council, with equal prize money, with the co-gender tournaments, and how sometimes the girls get a lower level hotel than the guys in Europe, right? Do you feel like you all need to be invited back into the room because you're still fighting similar struggles?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I think that what we could offer would be considerable. And it would be nice that we can get to know and say, yeah, I've met, you know, Barty, or I've met, you know, Sabalenko, I've met the other players. But we don't know who they are. When I have friends say, have you met, you know, any of the players, young players? No, I don't know Raducanu. I don't know Fernandez. I don't know any of them. And it would be nice, because then we would start to have a nice connection for them to understand the history. And I know WTA does their best to try and make them understand where they've come from. But, you know, I think it would be a nice thing to, and I know everybody does know Billie Jean, you know, because she's global. But the rest of them, to be able to, you know, at least meet them, talk to them. And I know that they have mentoring programs, and I've never been a part of it. And I think that certainly some of the players should, you know, older players should be on a representative on a board. You know, it floors me that not one of the past players are on the board, you know, to represent whatever. You know, we keep updated, you know, we understand how the game has changed, both in the physical way and how you play it, but it would be nice to know a lot more and be in the end of the sport that you started.
Mm-hmm. And I think even if it was a informal sort of mentor, mentee, even a gentle introduction, like, hey, you know, because BJK can't help everybody, right? I mean, you know, she can't help top 100. Every top 100 player can't just solely reach out to her. If we could just sort of distribute, you know, some of that to make some connectivity, be like, hey, you know, you're going to be faced with this challenge, or your style resembles this person. Talk to her about how she was successful. Yep. You know, Rosie's 5'2", right? Yep. Talk about how she won 112. She held 112 trophies, right? So like, that's not a small number, right? So I'm coaching a player, and just last Sunday got her 7 trophy. So I'm thinking, I'm like, wow, it's taken a lot of work to get 7. You got 112.
Now, granted, as I say, you know, we were starting, and certainly the competition isn't what it is now, without a doubt. And we understand that today you got to be ready to perform in a first round because you're going to get a tough match. So, but nonetheless, we understand that. And, you know, we understand that games change. Look at the players, so much bigger, so much stronger. All that they get in nutrients, in fitness, and in coaching, and in how they travel. I mean, those that have money travel, you know, privately, and understandably, they can afford it. And, you know, there are better retirement plans for them already than there ever was for us. We're still trying to get our $5,000 from WTA, from the, you know, whatever pension plan was sort of put together. And it's just a different life and a different time, we understand. But I think that, yeah, there's always some things that bring you together, whether you're number one today or you were number one yesterday. You know, there are things, especially in the game, that one built and, you know, had certainly a lot of inspiration that it would grow into something. Perhaps, you know, our minds didn't wrap around what it is today, but certainly the progress, it was, I know we're going to get there. I know we're going to get there. And you know, there's still a lot of work to be done because tomorrow I could be all gone. I mean, look, you know, more money, the promoters have to put up more risk, more everything. I mean, you know, yes, you watch the tennis channel, the 3-4 turns going on, you know, at the same time, very global, understood. But in a moment's notice, I mean, look what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. I mean, the wars, you know, it can impact, it can go into Europe. All of a sudden things change. You have no tennis. What are you going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. So, yeah, I think, you know, the players have to perform, yes, and they have to also get involved. And I think they need to leave legacies, just like our generation left the legacy. And then you had Chris and Martina and Tracy, and they left legacies and so forth. And I think now less so. We have to leave. Every generation's got to get better, has gotten better, and they need to do more for the game, more for the sport. We need to ensure that this is going to continue to grow and be the sport that we love and that has nurtured us and kept us going.
So you talk about legacy and like sort of growing the sport. You know, when I think of Palm Springs, it is sort of symbolic of what tennis is in my tennis experience. And it is a lot of tennis, but all in gated communities, right? And so there's like so much tennis around the world, but there's always this like, this hint and aura of inaccessibility. Talk about what you're doing now, because you know, one of our first introductions was Billy. You know, Billy introduced me to you and said, hey, come out, you got to meet this great player that Rosie's working with, Taylor Johnson, and she's like still coaching. You guys should talk. Tell us about like your legacy you're leaving now by touching some of these players. And obviously Taylor went on, you know, is at UCLA
right now.
And that's, you know, you definitely had a big part in that. So talk about your legacy now and what you're doing with the kids and about what we need to do to get it out of the gated communities, right? Symbolically, and into neighborhoods.
Yeah, well, that's a challenge here. As I said to you, we're surrounded by underserved kids and communities and my foundation, the Love and Love Tennis Foundation, and you know, that's part of the NJTL now and USTA. So we're trying to, you know, come up with programs that will be outreaching and continuous. And what's difficult is, like I said, we go to Coachella Valley in the east, you know, a lot of agriculture and migrants, and very far from being able to come to the tennis gardens. If I was supposed to put a clinic together, it's all about transportation. The parents work, can't do it. So what I'm doing is reaching out to all the high schools in those different areas: Coachella Valley High School, Desert Hot Springs, and North, again underserved, in the west and north part of Palm Springs. You have the African American community. It's far for them to come into the tennis gardens and Indian Wells and Ranch Mirage. So, you know, I'm working with the high schools and trying to have their tennis team put together clinics, free clinics. We have them giving free clinics 1 hour every week. And if we could step it up to twice a week, we will. And so I've got 5 or 6 involved in that. And Fila has been great in assisting somewhat with sponsoring. And so, you know, we feel that if we could keep it in their community, and fortunately the tennis courts are available when the team's not playing, but they're willing to do this, and we give them grants for their equipment or transportation and travel and whatever they may need. And you know, we think they're serving their community. And I also work with the Boys and Girls Club, and we go in there and to the little gyms, and we help the kids learn how to play tennis. And so how we could spread the word, because I've got to say, tennis has been great to me, and I cannot even imagine what my life could have been or would have been had I not hit that white at the time tennis ball. Now we got a yellow ball. And so it's amazing how much the game has grown. But on the other hand, when we look at other sports, and especially team sports, we are still way behind that.
Yeah.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
So you talk about working with the high school kids. One of the things, like now when you think about high school athletes, right? They say they graduate high school, they can go and start playing professional tennis. And within 2 or 3 years, with some level of success, you will make a postgraduate salary. But back in the 70s, right, and in the 60s, it wasn't so clear cut. So college was still a good option, because it wasn't like you were going to make $1 million in the next 2 years playing tennis. So how did you decide not to go to college and to go pro?
Oh, that was an easy decision. I hated school. It was never my favorite thing. I couldn't wait to get out of school. So when I finally graduated and I was 17 and Billie Jean had asked me to go to Wimbledon and play with her, I couldn't believe it. So, you know, getting an education, I think, is important for many of them, because not everybody can make a transition into becoming a pro and going into either WTA or ATP. So things are changing now. I mean, the opportunity for us was really very limited. There was no professional tennis. There was no money. It was all about the love of the game and getting money under the table if you were decent. So, you know, you never really knew, but you were hopeful. And if you were decent, you would at least cover your expenses and make a little bit on the side. And so, you know, Title IX didn't come into the picture, I think, till 1972. And again, scholarships for women in sports, and you couldn't pursue. And so, you know, the opportunities were not available to us. And fortunately, as Title IX came into the picture, of course, scholarships for women and sports and stuff and education really happened. And so, you know, I still have women that come up to us and thank us for having paved the way for that. And, you know, it makes you feel good that you contributed that kind of inspiration and hard work and trying to get things to change for women, because it has been an uphill battle for women, for sure. And it's so great to be able to see them making equal prize money or pretty much close to that now in tennis. You know, when I look at soccer, they're struggling, they're fighting, they deserve it. I look at ice hockey for the women. I mean, you know, they're struggling, they're fighting like we were, but, you know, they haven't quite obtained the success that we were fortunate. And we were very fortunate to have gotten Philip Morris and Virginia Slims with lots of money. At that time, it was lots of money for us. But now it would be a whole different story. You know, you would need a whole lot more money. But things were right in the 70s. Things were right for women. You know, we had the women's lib movement. We had the change from the closed era to open era tennis. And so, you know, there were booming times in the early 70s for tennis. Probably the 73 through 75 were the most progressive time for tennis.
So let me ask you got as high as 3 in the world, right? And maybe at that time, there wasn't as big of a financial difference between 3 and number 1. I've spoken to somebody before and they said, you know what? I never wanted to be number 1 because I could make the same money at 2 or 3 without all the pressure of being number 1. What do you think about that statement?
Oh, well, okay. Either you know yourself well and you're complacent with that. And I think, you know, that's okay for somebody to say that. Because if you feel you don't want to put in, or you do not have the discipline, or do you have the talent or ability to become number one? I mean, certainly I wanted to be number one, and I regret that I was unable to win at least one slam in singles, won them in doubles, but not in singles, came close. And I always felt I could, and that is very motivating. I mean, I was motivated by the fact that I did want to be number one. But then comes Billie Jean and Margaret Court and Yvonne Goulden and everybody to spoil things for me. So it was like I never really had my moment, my little, you know, sometimes that happens in you know, somebody's career that you're not quite, you know, like you have the Agassiz and the, you know, Pete Sampras and, you know, whatever, and you're trying to get in there and it's tough, or the Murrays and the Rogers and the Nadals, and you're trying to make your way. Now they're kind of gone, except Rafa's still hanging around playing great tennis, but you have the younger generation, obviously, with Zverev and, you know,
team and,
you know, Medvedev. So yeah, there's room there for them to move to number one, and they have, and for the women as well. I mean, it's wide open for the women, but when you had Billie Jean and Margaret Court and, you know, some of Virginia Wade that were very close in that, and Ann Jones and, you know, whatever. Yeah, you have to be fortunate to come in a good time.
I remember when Serena went and got pregnant. And Wozniacki had 2 years there when she slipped into number one. I know. Yeah. Serena said, I'm pregnant. And Wozniacki said, yes, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, of course. You know, so you do have to have a combination of things. You got to be lucky. You got to be there in the right time, at the right place, and take advantage of your moment.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we just took advantage of you. I really do appreciate everything that you do. I know you have the Level Up Foundation with Tori Fretz. Tell us, I know you talked about the high schools, but this year you're honoring Billie Jean King.
Yes.
I gotta ask you, you won 112 titles, 56 with Billie Jean. Did you carry her or did she carry you?
Well, I think we did a little bit of both, and I think that's what happens in doubles, you know? when you're not firing up, your partner's gotta pick up the slack. And when they're not firing up, you got to pick up the slack. And I think that's what makes a good doubles team. We were very compatible. We had the game that, you know, we enjoyed playing serve and volley at the time. And I still say a serve and volley will beat whatever's out there today. I wish I could challenge that, but I can't because I'm too old. But I still say, whoever gets their butt up to net is going to control the match.
Now, let me ask you this. Talking about controlling the match, who played the ad side?
She did. You know, sometimes we change. Sometimes we change. But basically, she played the ad. I would get her the ad. She'd have to clinch it. My job was get the ad, let her clinch it. She, you know, like her saying goes, pressure is a privilege. Give and like pressure. I said, like I say, that's bullshit. You can erase that. But hey. I said, you know, she loves it. And I never felt that way, but I handled it as well as I could, you know. But I didn't embrace it the way she did.
That's right. She wants that pressure. Go ahead, take that sign, right?
I said, you take that ad.
Well, thank you so much, Rosie.
Well, thank you. Good luck next week, and I will catch up with you, okay?
All right, thank you. This has been a Tennis.com podcast. We had the privilege of being with one of the original nine, 112-time title holder on the WTA Tour, a mentor to many. Rosie Casale, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a good one. Bye-bye.